Good morning, everybody, and welcome to our interims results presentation. I don't know about you, but I can't believe 6 months has gone by. It's just whizzed by. Could I just have a bit of housekeeping? If you've got a mobile on, which includes me probably, but could you switch it off? And could you note that the presentation is being recorded on our audio webcast? And lastly, could we keep questions until the end so that Paul doesn't lose his flow in the numbers?
Very, very helpful.
Could I also acknowledge that our chairman, our good chairman, Mark Nicholls, is here at the back, who would be happy to take questions at the end or at coffee afterwards. In terms of the order of play, we'll probably speak for about 40 minutes, but we want to leave good time for questions and answers at the end of this session. And that discussion can spill over to coffee afterwards, but I suspect a number of you will need to run away because it's a very busy announcement day. In terms of the agenda, I will first of all address our announcement regarding the legal proceedings and our conditional settlement. Paul will then take over and present our financial results. I'm very pleased that this time round, as promised, Mike Webb has joined us. Mike is the CEO of our unit trust business, but also a member of the executive committee of the group and has responsibility for marketing and distribution within his remit as well. And then I'll finish off with just a quick review of where the business is and how we see the rest of the year going. So with no more ado, let's move to the settlement of the legal proceedings. And I'm assuming you all have read the announcement. There is a copy in your pack, if you haven't. My first plea is, please understand that we're still bound and will be bound by very strict confidentiality constraints. So what I have to say will, in some ways, frustrate you. The history of this, the underlying claim, involves legal proceedings that came and involved a former director and employee of a former Jersey subsidiary, Rathbones Trust Company Jersey Limited, and other parties. So it's not just that former employee of the former subsidiary of Rathbones. It concerned claims of gross negligence in the management of investments over quite a number of years. And then in parallel with that, we incurred or got involved in associated legal proceedings against certain of our professional indemnity insurers who sought to claim that the coverage we had was invalid. And that parallel action led to a court case last October in which we won on all the substantive issues, but lost on one highly technical, complicated piece of law, which we felt was misapplied. And both parties then went into appeal. So it was a cross-appeal situation. And that appeal hearing was concluded just a couple of weeks ago. And judgment from that appeal is probably most likely to come out in the autumn, somewhere around October. We don't know precisely. So what we've been dealing with is a situation where Rathbones is not or has not been a direct party to the claim and the legal proceedings, but has been drawn into those proceedings by virtue of the indemnification arrangement with that former employee. And I have to say, it's been a Rubik's Cube of complexity involving these multiple parties, multiple investments over many years. It goes back over 15 years. There's a story before that. Last night, late last night, we finally reached an all-parties agreement to conditionally settle. I'll explain that condition in a minute. We still hold, as Rathbones, a belief that the underlying case eventually would prove unsuccessful. And we also hold the view that following the appeal hearing, effective insurance cover would be confirmed. But the problem, the challenge for the board and my colleagues, has been to balance that confidence against three things. Firstly, I think you're all aware litigation is never without its risks. It's never watertight. There's always the chance of something cropping up that goes against us. The second is that cumulatively, these proceedings have cost us over £5 million up to the half year of 30th of June, and we face the prospect of substantial legal fees going forward in a case which could rumble on for several more years. And then lastly, we felt it was in the overall best interests of the company, and in particular allowing myself and my senior management to focus on what we should be doing, which is our strategy and the growth of the business. And it's for that reason that we entered into the settlement agreement. It's conditional simply in the sense that the final event will be the Royal Court in Jersey putting a permanent stay, effectively ceasing the legal case in Jersey and all parties agreeing to compromise. Another point I'd just like to stress is that our £15 million contribution is part of a much larger sum. I'm sorry, but I can't tell you what the numbers are or what the contributions are. But all the parties on the insurance side and the other parties in the proceedings will have contributed. So that is the legal proceedings. How do we react? If I'm honest, the first word is relief. This is one of those Donald Rumsfeld's known unknowns taken out of our lives and forever. So relief is the word, and we're very pleased to have got it to conclusion. The second feeling is one of conviction that this is the right commercial decision. And the third feeling is absolutely clear that this does not in any way impede our strategic growth plans. In fact, quite the contrary, we would hope that our shareholders see this as a positive in terms of removing that unknown uncertainty that we faced. So that's the legal proceedings. We can pick it up at the end with more questions and answers. But as I say, please understand that I can't go into much more detail than that. With that passed over, I'll ask Paul to take us through our results.
So now for the good news. Cast your mind back to the first 6 months of 2014, when, frankly, the markets ended roughly where they started. So please have that in mind as you look at the numbers that you see on the screen at the moment. With funds under management reaching £23.9 billion, up 8.6%. That includes some funds, some £617 million funds from the acquisition of Deutsche. But effectively, it doesn't include any funds under management from the Jupiter acquisition, which we announced in April, which essentially will come in, we expect, towards the end of September. Why have funds grown? Other than that, well, a pretty good organic growth and pretty good acquired growth. One could say more of the same, but we never take it for granted. In a flat market, it is not easy to grow, but we are continuing to do so. Effectively, because the Deutsche funds didn't come in until the end of June, they don't have any impact on profit before tax. So therefore, underlying profit before tax growing to £29.6 million is largely a result of a little bit of market movement because we are in better markets than we were 12 months ago, but also some cumulative underlying growth. That is also reflecting, as you might imagine, in underlying earnings per share. But bear in mind as well that we issued 1.3 million shares in a placing also in April, which has a weighted average impact on the EPS to date already. And there'll be obviously the full impact of that in the second half. But I think we were very keen to stress that in spite of what Philip's just said, we are focusing our approach to dividends on the business continuing and these strong results, and therefore have put one penny on the dividend, rising to 19 pence per share. Looking at the P&L in a little bit more detail, As I said, markets had a little bit of help when you look year on year. And whilst the FTSE went up 7.8%, APKIMS was up, the APKIMS Balanced Index was up 5.6%. So the rest of that overall growth in fee income, up to 15.6% increase year on year, is down to continuing growth in Rathbones. Now, many of our peers have been talking about commission income. We had a very strong first quarter, as you'll have read from our first quarter announcement. Flat markets are never terribly good for commissions, so that message is really getting around the marketplace at the moment. We're no exception to that. And also, we have a seasonal impact year, half one to half two, in the fact that normally we'd expect about 55% of our commissions to happen in half one, 45% in half two. With a flat market, you know, that may change within a few percentage points, but there is a degree of seasonality there. Net interest income is up, but only a little bit. Of course, none of you are strangers to the fact that we are still in a very compressed interest rate environment. And essentially, we're still looking forward, I suppose, to that decompressing at some point in time. And market commentary tends to be supportive of that increasingly as we read in the media. Loan interest is up about 30% in that number, so has offset to some extent what are continually poor rates in the Treasury market. The liquidity is up a little bit, but is not really changing the dial. The other, I suppose, very small legacy issue that we've resolved in the first half was the repayment of loan notes, which were the last vestige of consideration from the sale of our offshore trust business, and we managed to get those away £600,000 more than we had them in the books. So there's a small gain there of 0.6, which is included in other income. Note for the future, obviously that won't reoccur. And if you look at our overall underlying profit margin, really a steady-as-she-goes message there, really, with a 30% resounding result in the first half. Looking at expenses, just remember we're a growing business, so in a way, this is a relatively dull story this time. If you look at the fixed staff costs, you can see they're up 7.3%, but it's not a surprise to anyone, I think, that we're hiring a few more people. Philip will talk about our plans for the future in just a second, but that's a very normal growth story in terms of headcount, and obviously the salary inflation, which is in the fixed staff cost number as well. And indeed, other direct expenses, that's where we've booked 1.1 million of legal expenses in the first half relating to the case that Philip was just referring to. And 5.3 million year to date, you'll see in the announcement, not year to date, to date, 5.3 million to date we've spent trying to work out and get a resolution on the legal case. I think that helps because those numbers tend to put the 15 million in context. And we do hope to get a tax deduction on the 15 million too. So in capital terms, that will be less of an issue. Variable staff costs, I've mentioned this before, I know, but they are worthy of comment, being up 25.5% year on year. But in a way, if you understand what's driving that, largely higher profits, continued growth over a three-year period, and indeed a higher share price also is factored into those numbers. There's possibly one other thing which I just would like to flag is that we have tightened our policy somewhat in terms of amortising intangibles. Now, those of you who are familiar with our results will normally see that goes below the line as an amortisation cost. Well, essentially, when investment managers who join us, who are under earn-out arrangements, have completed 12 months after their non-compete, any clients that they bring in after that, we are now booking to P&L. And that's just a tightening of our policy because we're recognising that there's only a certain amount of time that it takes to bring in what are determined as legacy clients. And that essentially has added about £900,000 to our P&L that ordinarily, historically, would have gone to amortisation below the line. And we're doing that, so it's accelerated goodwill. So that's another factor that's in here. The reason I raise it, 0.9 million isn't a great big number and is not an alarm, but one day where we have an extremely successful team that does manage to bring a lot of clients in after that 12 months post non-compete, I just want you to look me in the eye and say, don't worry, Paul, you warned us about that. Okay. So the rest of it is okay in terms of expenses. There are one or two things that we have put below the line. The normal one, and that's the one I've referred to, is charges in relation to client relationships and goodwill. That's the amortization write-off. That's the capitalization and amortization. That's the normal cost. And you can see that goes on every year. No surprise that that's going up because the business has grown. We sold some London Stock Exchange shares. Easy for me to say. This year, essentially, that's a rebadge from our balance sheet that was already marked to market. So we're recycling that through the P&L, not a value changer. But of course, we've been busy on transactions as well. So, putting £1 million below the line just to indicate what the costs of that have been, I didn't think was too cheeky. So if you look at the overall result, pretty strong growth in profits, up 13.4, but obviously skewed by those one-offs that I've talked about, under a big profit before tax, bottom line profit before tax, up 33%. An effective tax rate going forward, well, we've benefited from the government essentially reducing the rate of corporation tax. That essentially will go down another 1% as we go into 2015. So just bear that in mind in all of your forecasts for EPS going forward. Just looking at profit margin very quickly before I hand over to Mike, a few things to really remember here. As markets move up and down, so do our fee revenue margin. As we've been looking at some of the models that are out there, it's just important that flexibility is reflected in those models. Our fee margin does change because they are tiered fee rates. So don't be surprised if our revenue margin goes down a basis point in a rising market, or indeed goes up a basis point in a falling market. I mentioned commissions. That's one thing to just to bear in mind. It's not the best environment for that. And I've mentioned the loan notes too. But also to mention acquisitions. The full revenue effect and indeed earnings effect of the Deutsche acquisition that will now be felt in the second half of 2014. And Jupiter, and we'll announce in our third quarter how we're getting on with that, that will impact the last quarter of 2014. The full year impact of all of that, of course, of both of those acquisitions will be in 2015. I should mention the Bank of England base rate. As I said, commentary is a little bit more positive than it has been historically. Just to give you some idea, on an annualised basis, a 1% rise in base rates should equate to roughly £6 million in PBT. So just to really exemplify the fact that we are still in that interest rate compression phase. So in terms of expenses, Philip will talk in a moment about headcount plans, so I shall leave that to him, but please bear in mind that that naturally will have a cost implication, but we are a growing business. Variable awards can go either way, and I hope now that we won't be telling you about ongoing legal costs as a result of this settlement. So just some things to bear in mind as you look at the margin. The balance sheet is unsurprising. I put it up here really for good order. It's not a surprise that we've increased balances with the Bank of England, given that they really do have a zero risk weight and are paying base rate at the moment. But we do have £600 million in the Bank of England. Intangible assets up a little bit, unsurprisingly, again, because of acquisitions and the pension deficit. Well, that just bumps up and down depending on where long-term gilt yields are. But our overall capitalisation is in pretty good shape as at the 30th of June, as you can see here with our Tier 1 ratio at just shy of 23% and leverage ratio just shy of 11%. Consistent cash, capital expenditure. Well, yes, indeed. I do drone on about this pretty much every half year, but I think it's really important just to keep stressing that we are continuing to invest. You can see here, and we'd be accountable for the cash capital expenditure we spend. And again, no surprise, if you were to double up half one 2014, you get to a very similar number to as it was in 2013. And that is about our consistent message of investing in infrastructure. And we'll talk about, Philip will talk about in a second, where that money's been spent. That's the results. I look forward to questions in a second. And happily hand over to Mike.
Thank you, Paul. Good morning, everybody. I joined in early 2010 to take over the unit trust business, which had been suffering somewhat after a difficult 2008-09. So I thought I'd just spend the first couple of minutes bringing you through those succeeding years. The primary goal in the early years was to try and stabilise the business and then put the momentum back underneath it in order to make it grow. That did take some investment, and I'll talk about that in a second. But as you can see from the left-hand side of the chart, momentum has very much occurred in the unit trust business. What you can see there is the 12-month rolling growth in funds under management against the FTA All Share. And you can see very strong growth in spite of very lacklustre markets. I think we were talking about it today, the FTA All Share is up something like 1.9% since the beginning of the year. In terms of the right-hand side, you can see the momentum of the gross and net sales. I would draw your attention to 2012, which was the teeth of the euro crisis. In spite of that, we managed to complete four quarters of net growth. And the momentum really beginning to come through in 2013. You can see in the first half of 2014, we've sold as much as we did in the whole of 2013. So the momentum is strong. But I would warn you that obviously we had an excellent fourth quarter in 2013. So in terms of sales growth numbers, that will start to flatten in terms of the whole of 2014, although we'll still be very strong. In relation to what we're selling, I think it's important to note that we are not simply reliant on our income fund. It is a very important mandate for us. And we have been growing investment staff in that area to support it. However, we're seeing strong growth in our global opportunities, our ethical bond funds, and in other retail mandates and unit trusts. So part of this is to try and make sure that we're selling across a range as opposed to being terrifically reliant on one particular product. Within that, I would point to the multi-asset funds. These are outcome-orientated funds, which I believe will have much more relevance to the market in a post-suitability world, and I'll come back to that in a second. So really what I wanted to do is talk very briefly about some of the big industry trends and how we're positioned strategically to take advantage of those. The first point in terms of industry trends is the buying concentration issue. The press has been talking about this. I believe Deloitte's produced a paper suggesting that buying power of funds is concentrated in the UK to within 150 individuals. That, by the way, is a wild exaggeration, but it does point to the fact that buying power is concentrating not just in a fewer number of individuals, but also in more professional fund analyst outfits. This is creating quite an interesting phenomenon in that we are seeing the rise of what I can only describe as beer moth funds that rise from 500 million to 5 billion within 18 months. And I believe do not act in the interests of underlying investors because there's no way you can generate the same sort of returns with that size fund than you did with a 500 million pound fund. That, frankly, I think will lead to some fragmentation. And that presents a very good opportunity for businesses like ours, which specialise in a number of areas, which are willing to capacity constrain and will help us retain some margin. The second major issue is restricted versus independent. Again, a lot of people are saying that this might be the death knell of smaller investment groups. I fundamentally disagree with that for two reasons. First of all, the concept of restricted is not the same as it was in the old polarized world of restriction, where very few companies were used. In most restricted models that we're seeing today, the investment selection portion of that is based on whole of market, whether that's through fund of funds or whether that's through a recommended list. And so we're not seeing a diminution of opportunity in that space. The third is the rise of the consultant, and this speaks to the essential institutionalization of fund selection amongst professionals dealing with, again, our professionals. The really important part of that is that they are not concerned with brand. They are less concerned with brand. They are much more concerned with product efficiency and how well that product is being run and its consistency and its sustainability. That opens the doors for specialists when you're dealing against big, big brands like M&G and Invesco Perpetual. And finally, the risk-rated versus risk-targeted argument. We are seeing a move, particularly amongst those financial advisors, moving into an outsourced space where risk is far more important than returns. And that's because in the suitability worlds, their biggest liability is their ability to understand a client's capacity for loss and their risk profile, both initial and ongoing. So unless you are very expert in monitoring and continuing to monitor portfolio construction, they are starting to look for outcome-driven solutions that have risk targets embedded in them. And that is exactly what our multi-asset funds do. So we believe that the market is now beginning to move more towards that area. Indeed, my experiences in the US would tell us that after a bit of a false dawn in the late 90s, this type of investing is becoming very popular over there as well. All of this, perhaps, and RDR with its transparency, has led to a number of discussions on margin pressure. And there is no question that transparency does generate margin pressure. In 2010, our business had an average return of basis points of about just over 69 basis points. Today, it's 60.5. We have always budgeted for a margin compression, and we will continue to do so. However, we have been able to resist, in the main, margin pressure. And that is because there's been a fundamental misunderstanding of the platform environment, where platforms believe they control pricing pressure, but actually don't control the end customers. And where that's the case, we have been able to resist. In direct-to-consumer platforms, we have selectively used super-institutional charges to make sure that we form a core part of their investment proposition, and we have seen volume uplifts as a result of that. Regulatory-wise, we are inundated day-to-day from various FCA and ESMA edicts. At the moment, we're very focused on a number of issues. Conflicts of interest, we have spent a lot of time ensuring that we absolutely will meet those requirements. In inducements, where again we have a very strict policy in terms of inducements. And then dealing commissions. Dealing commissions, I think, are probably the highest risk to an asset management business. The latest FCA paper pointed to the MiFID II piece of legislation, which is due to come in 2017, if it comes in as worded, will prevent asset managers from charging research to the funds, which means they have to take it through the P&L. We will be working on that to ensure that we absolutely understand how we're going to arrange our research going forwards. But in the meantime, we have put in a number of controls to ensure that we understand the value of the research we're paying for and can justify that to the unit holders. All of this is set against, therefore, the strategy that we want to pursue. It's not that exciting. It's quite basic. It is concentrate on organic growth. Make sure we keep a concentrated portfolio of funds. Do not try and be all things to all men. Make sure that we're incubating some funds that can become the engine for growth as capacity is reached in our existing mandates, and we have done a lot of work on that. And we're very happy with some of the medium-term outlook for funds like the Recovery Fund, for our Strategic Bond Fund, amongst others. The next point I wanted to make was around operational leverage. We have been investing relatively heavily back into the business, particularly in distribution and marketing, and strengthening our front office. That really occurred during the periods from 2010 to 2012. And as a result, we saw operating leverage fall to about 6.4% in 2012. In 2013, that rose to 12.4%. 12.6%. And in 2014, the first half, we're seeing operating margins of around 23%. So we expect to reach the 30% target in due course. And it's very important, obviously, for an asset management business to use its operational leverage. We also want to take advantage of the outsourcing opportunity. Many financial advisors are now looking to outsource their investment propositions. Rathbones as a whole is uniquely positioned to offer solutions from £1,000 to £100 million plus. And that is something we intend to continue to drive and take advantage of that opportunity. We will continue to invest in staff, particularly in relation to our investment platform. If you do not have investment excellence, you don't get to play at the party. It's as simple as that. The other main issue that I want to just talk very briefly about is to ensure that we are integrating as much as possible with the broader business. When I took over, we were essentially two separated businesses, and what we've tried to do is to look at where integration would make sense from a resource point of view, from an intellectual property point of view, and gain competitive advantage. We have done that in terms of our investment platform, where we are significant contributors into the investment engine that drives the wealth management side. We have supported both acquisitions in terms of mopping up a lot of what would have been extremely difficult issues from private unit trusts to subscale unit trusts. And we have launched funds on behalf of colleagues across the broader business to allow them to provide solutions for clients where segregated accounts would not make sense. The most obvious example of that being the Active Income Fund for Charities, which is growing quite nicely. In the second half, we will be looking at how the sales resource that Rutham now provides, which has incredible expertise in the advisor market, can be brought to bear to sell and maintain the opportunities across the UK financial advisor marketplace, but offering and talking about the products and services across Rathbones. And I'll be delighted to talk about that as we implement a strategy. So all in all, I think we leave Rutham in a very strong position. There is this thought that asset management and wealth management businesses don't sit well together as bedfellows. I believe that actually this is the ideal place to be housed, as the retailisation, if you'll pardon the horrible American expression, takes place both in the pensions and retail markets. We have within an intelligence of what actually customers and clients really think and are able to therefore produce solutions that are appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. So turning to a wider review of the business, first on slide 13, we provide a bit more of a breakdown and some comments on our growth in total funds under management to 23.9 billion. Just a reminder, that's up from 19.9 same time last year, or 22 billion at the year end. So quite reasonable growth there. What are the key drivers? Firstly, net organic growth in the main investment management business of £417 million. That's a 4.1% annualised rate, slightly below my through the cycle 5% target, which I've spoken about. But satisfactory and slightly reflecting the charities business, which is lumpy and you either get a large amount or you don't at any one time. It's not seasonal, it just comes in lumps and unexpectedly. So it's satisfactory and we're putting a lot of effort into that. Secondly, a fairly stellar performance by the unit trust business with net inflows of £338 million. That compares to £67 million same time last year. So, as Mike says, very good momentum. And then thirdly, clearly, our purchased growth, which is £819 million in the period. And that includes the Deutsche private client acquisition at £617 million. I'll talk about that in a minute. The observation from the numbers is really the 7% outflow, which seems to be consistent with industry experience, and which we spoke about last time I presented. But we do break that out because you'll see the retained accounts, which is roughly 70% of clients are retained. So funds are going out mostly to fund property acquisition for themselves or children, or as a lifestyle supplement during this low interest environment. So I don't see in the near term that profile of 7% changing. And we seem to be seeing it across the industry, as I said. But it's just worth holding that, because to get to my 5, we've got to keep growing at 12. On slide 14, I just turn to an update on the acquisitions. There are details for you to go through there. The Deutsche acquisition completed at the 5th of June and achieved over 95%, so £617 million. Just to put that in perspective, that was achieved in under 8 weeks from closing on the 1st of April to that 5th of June date. It's an incredible endorsement, frankly, of the calibre of the investment management team we acquired. And we still are seeing clients come in because we have a further period in which to draw them in under a regulatory waiver, a sort of forbearance period, where all clients have been transferred into us who hadn't signed, and we have a bit of time to tidy that up. These are clients, in some cases, who are complicated trusts or elderly in care homes, etc., who need help. So there is a forbearance period. So all in all, that has been a very successful acquisition. Turning to the Jupiter acquisition, I think we can't go into too much detail now, but it's well on track. It's progressing towards the 26th of September weekend, when there will be a big bang transfer of the business and the staff across to Rathbones. And we are already very close to justifying what was the minimum consideration for this transaction at £32 million in terms of clients who have already signed up. So it augurs well with where we are today. And whilst we've got a slide with our two big acquisitions up behind me, I should always remind you that at any one time we're out there hiring teams, and we have two team scenarios in motion at the moment, partially announced and partially unannounced. One team from Investec and another team from Smith & Williamson. So the ones who are on board are still subject to their restrictive covenants, so not able to bring clients in. So there's the normal sort of momentum of team hiring inside the story at the same time. I just don't want you to lose sight of that. I warned you last time that we were taking on a very busy agenda as a business, and we have a lot on the go, and I'll just give you a few insights to that programme of development of the business. At the year end, I shared with you that there were some 40 work streams to be incepted this year, based on 4 major building blocks: growth initiatives, operational efficiency, our investment process, and resource management as the sort of major building blocks of the business. And the slides, the next 2 slides, just give you an insight to it. I'm not going to, it's a busy slide, it's worth looking at in your own time, but let me just pick up some of the sort of major achievements. The first we spoke of quite a lot last time, which was the creation of teams, and that particularly applied to our London office with some 130 professionals. And we have actually restructured that. We've now gone very contemporary. We don't talk about teams in that sense. We talk about clouds. So we now have 4 clouds and a charities cloud. And then within that, the teams have formed. But with a great deal of thinking about how we put individuals together, those who are skilled in portfolio management and those who are more equipped for asset gathering and client relationship management. So this is all towards getting that organic growth rate motoring still better. The second point I draw out is our increasing success in the IFA intermediary market. And you'll see there that we've moved to 39% of new business in the first half was linked to IFAs or intermediary business, which Mike is leading as an initiative. That's up from about 33% last time we spoke. That goes well. That includes, I should note, Vision, in which we have a 19.9% equity stake and an option to go to full control next year. Mike has mentioned the unit trust business, I would just like to re-emphasize how integral we see that business to our intellectual capability. If we turn to operational efficiency, I'd pull out two things here. The first we spoke of a lot, and I think most of you had it demonstrated, which is our front-end technology, in which we've made a very large investment over the last 2 years. And the asset allocation modelling tool in particular is now rolled out to all investment managers and still is in process of moving and converting portfolio onto it. But to see that 20% of all our trades are now passed through that system just points to the efficiency and therefore the time capacity that we're seeking to build into the business. Drop down a couple of points, and we have just delivered the first phase of our new online service for clients. That's part of a three-phase development over the next few years. This is a huge improvement for the business, and again, all part of our digital strategy. If you turn to the next slide, the investment process, what would I pull out here? We have continued through the first half to make major strides in ensuring our suitability and risk management processes inside the core investment management business. It's a huge achievement, next point, to become GIPS accredited, which is a global standard, and I believe you'll find that we are the first UK, the only UK private client manager to be GIPS accredited. There may be subsidiaries of big international private banks, but in terms of our peer group, we will be the first to achieve that. And then lastly, you'll see the investment in research analysts, which is part of our strategy, and there'll be further announcements in that space. If we turn to resource management, the big message when I last spoke to you was the movement from being rather reactive to our requirements to being more forward-looking at the senior management and skills we required to fulfil our strategic plans. And I'm pleased to say, you'll see under the investment process, we have secured a head of investment process and risk who joins in September. We've secured a very senior, very experienced head of strategy and organisation development, that's code for HR, who joins us in September. And we're well advanced in the recruitment of a chief risk officer for the group. And we've also identified the future leader of our super high net worth family office strategy. And he should be in position later in the year. I major on training, and that has continued. You'll see that we've run a huge amount of training, both professionally but also in leadership and management terms, through the business. And then lastly, yes, we have to grow our support staff, but we're doing it in a very controlled way, running that tooth-to-tail ratio, as we see it, as carefully as we can. So on slide 17, I've provided you an insight to that. And you'll see that front-end staff under acquisitions and fee earners, hires that is, at 17 plus several in the garden, matches very well the what is in fact net increase of 11 in administration and support. We've had two investment management retirements in the period, so in that five retirements, three are support staff retirements, two are actually investment managers who will not be replaced. And that again goes to an efficiency in our average per investment management loading. In parallel with all that, there are a huge number of other projects in inception stage, whether they be improvement to the management information that we can provide our frontline staff, the review of our brand and brand positioning, which is going on at the moment, the planning for our super high net worth family office provision, and in risk. And all of that is tied up to the a five-year, very comprehensive strategy, which has been approved by the board. And the intention is that we will share that with you in the autumn, once we've briefed our staff first. So fairly big change on the go, as you can see. But I think the big plus is we are keeping our culture together, and the positive attitude in particular in operations, who are under huge pressure with these acquisitions, is still intact. So we don't lose sight of the culture and attitude of Rathbones in any of that. Finally, of course you've got a quote to go away with from me, which I'm not going to quote. But let me just give you what I think are the five, the big five issues we're going to be focused on in the next half. The first is clearly the integration of the acquisitions and hires we have on the go. The second is continuously driving our net organic growth, both in our investment management business and in our unit trust business. So huge efforts there to keep that up. There are further developments to be made in our investment process. The fourth is to carry on investing in skills and systems, in which we have plans. And lastly, strategic plans have to disintegrate at some stage into action, and it is taking those plans and putting them into proper action implementation plans. So the big five issues on the senior management's shoulders for the next half. But all in all, it's been a very exciting, a very hard-working first half by my colleagues. We've delivered and see the outlook as positive. There we go. That is our presentation. We will take questions now. There are some microphones. Could I ask you just to, for our record, state your name and origin before asking the question?
Thank you. It's Robin Savage from Canaccord. Mike, if I may ask you some questions on Rotem.
Sure.
Firstly, if you were to turn to slide 35, there is the performance of the various funds. Lots of top quartile and second quartile performance, but I note the third quartile performance in 2000 and the year for the year to date, or 1 year performance. Yep, 2014 year to date. I just wonder whether you could comment on an updated performance, and just secondly, can you talk about the capacity constraints? Now, I guess everyone can get greedy as to how big your fund could be, but all the various funds could be. Could you just talk about what sort of constraints you think there are in the various strategies? And thirdly, in terms of the underlying margins, you mentioned a lot of factors that would actually depress margins in terms of continuing investment, working together with your colleagues in the wealth management side. And just wonder whether, in your view, looking across to Paul Stockton, whether a margin of over 30% is actually reasonable, or whether actually 30% is a good level to be at if you're going to continue to invest.
Okay, I'll see if I can remember all three. firstly, in relation to performance, you're right that in 2014 year to date, it's been a very odd ride one way or another across a number of portfolios. The second half of this year has been very difficult for income type mandates. I'm pleased to report, however, that the latest rotation back towards slightly more defensive stocks away from high growth areas, which has really hurt some performance elsewhere, has pushed the income fund back into the second quartile. I guess the main point here, however, is that when I talk about investment excellence, I don't mean first quartile performance. What I'm saying is that we do exactly what we say we are going to do on the tin. And the investors in the income fund, by and large, other than a little bit of hot money, know exactly why they've bought Carl Stick and his team. So we haven't seen any complaints whatsoever in across any of our mandates. So I guess that's the first point. The second was capacity. We are nowhere near capacity in any of our mandates currently. We do monitor it every month to make sure that we don't reach a point where the investment process is compromised. And I'm happy to say that we can at least double from here across those mandates. Income fund, for instance, we believe we would need to start looking at soft closing somewhere between 2 and 2.5 billion. The second point I'd make around that is this idea of incubating funds. We do understand that we need to have other mandates being brought through over a period of time and building track records currently that can help to generate the next phase of growth. And then finally, the operating margin. I'm absolutely sure we can reach a 30% operating margin and maybe a little bit more. But I think once you get beyond that, actually, a sensibly run business is looking to reinvest excess operating leverage back into the business to ensure that it remains stable, that it remains on a growth path. So I think I would probably say that Paul would be smiling heavily at me once we reach 30% because it provides other options for investment.
Yeah, just to add, I wouldn't have expected a standalone Rathbone Unit Trust business to be sitting in Curzon Street paying that sort of rent either. So if he gets 30% with that sort of overhead, that's a very good result. John.
John Borgas, Equity Development. A few years ago, I was told that the policy was not to have in-house analysts doing research for Rathbone's investment management. I'm glad to see that you're hiring some analysts. Can I ask, what is your target number for analysts, for the analysts covering the UK market and other funds you're going to put people in? And are you intending to share any of these analysts with Rathbone's United Unit Trust Management?
Do you want me to say that? In terms of numbers, you can see from the slides in 2014, just trying to put my head back to where that was, I think we're talking about six recruits, either recruited or to be recruited through the rest of this year. Strategically, we're looking to increase that probably by about another four analysts. This will provide in-house research across both equity markets and collectives, and also provide support to the Strategic Asset Allocation Committee. What we're not trying to do is to supplant the other individuals involved in the analysis of our security selection, fund selection, and strategic views, which involves some 45 to 50 investment managers. We think it's really, really important that those people with genuine talent for that area should be involved in the creation of a very robust and progressive investment engine. So hopefully that gives you some sight of the kind of scale that we're trying to build. In our view, the investment engine has to be as strong as we can possibly make it, particularly in markets that tend to look at performance a little bit more than, say, some of the more elderly direct clients who value the client relationship. So it's part of ensuring that we've got both engines running at full pelt.
Thank you. And a quick question for Paul. I noticed that on note two, the variable staff costs on investment management have increased by more than the profit. You've said that some of this was down to the share price. How much of it?
About 300,000, John. That's roughly the increase year on year as a result of the share price. But the share price came down a little bit just before half year. I mean, that could have been at least double that with the share price at 21.60. I mean, as I say, bear in mind what's in that as well is that 900,000 of sort of accelerated goodwill, and that's what's essentially driving that number as well.
Sorry, wasn't obvious that the accelerated goodwill came under variable staff costs.
Yes, and the rationale for that is that after a period of time, looking at a very purist accounting perspective, there's a question mark as to whether that is a historical client base or it is as a result of the employee working at Rathbones that those clients are joining. And that's we've just chosen to make that cut off, to be prudent, effectively.
Thank you, that explains it.
Morning, it's David McCann from Numis. Just want to touch a bit more on this legal cost. Whilst I appreciate you said that it's going to be taken as an exceptional charge in the second half of this year, I'm just thinking about the capital position. To what extent have you already provided for this in the account, and therefore to what extent would the full 15 million not impact the capital? And secondly to that, you mentioned the possibility of a tax deduction for that. How confident are you that you will be able to get the full, presumably, tax at currently 21%? And then finally, to what extent was this in your mind when you did the placing a few months ago?
Okay. Okay, I'll try and take those in order. Again, I have to plead the fifth on accounting standards, but they don't allow me to book any provision until we really think there's a proper obligation. So in terms of a provision, that's why it's a second half, not a first half. Philip mentioned the complexities of this case, and they were certainly not well-formed at 30th of June because this was a very complicated thing. So in terms of provisioning in the accounts, it's a second half number.
Basically, provisioning zero taken so far for this?
Apart from the legal costs, obviously, to date. So zero in the numbers that you've seen today. For capital planning, of course, you know, we are a bank. We are continually looking, you know, 1 to 2 years ahead in terms of our, you know, capital plans. And, of course, in those capital plans, we try to be as prudent as we can in terms of looking at downside risk of either conduct or operational capital issues. So to some extent, you know, for the last, as long as we've had this 2 to 3 years that's been hanging over us, we've been looking at a capital, building up some capital as a result of this. So it isn't a complete surprise, but, you know, at the same time, the fact that we don't have 12 million, which is the number roughly net of tax, available for acquisitions, that's a fact. I can't hide behind that. I would have dearly loved to apply it to acquiring acquisitions. We just don't have that. And to give you some idea of what that impact is, we've got a Tier 1 capital ratio of over, let's say, 20-21% at the moment. After the Jupiter acquisition and reflecting this transaction, that will fall to roughly around 15%. So still reasonably well capitalised, I would say, enough to do, you know, at least another Deutsche transaction, for example. So, you know, what was it in our mind at placing? Well, of course, we were looking at downside risk, but only downside risk. Placing was a good opportunity to come to market. It was a good timing to come to market. We thought we'd seize the opportunity because we have and still have growth ambitions. So I don't think the two were related.
OK, and the tax, you are pretty confident
the, of? The tax, yes. I mean, at the moment, I'm obviously expect to book a tax deduction for that. The ultimate arbiter of that will be HMRC, but of course we'll be doing our utmost to make sure that we do have the tax. It is dependent on, you know, has this been in the interest of the company? We firmly believe it has, and therefore we'll be strongly arguing for that.
Okay, thank you very much for that clarification. Just one last question on slide 9, slide you always put in there about the capex. Yeah. I just wanted to put this in context. If you were to overlay the associated depreciation and amortisation charges kind of next to that, just to give us a sense of how much is it that you are spending over the, you know, kind of what's coming out, you know, so what's kind of the real net investment going into these things? That would just be useful if you could give us some colour on that.
Net of depreciation, how do you mean?
So, you know, obviously you've spent, what's that, so circa just over two million in the first half on this capex.
I mean, roughly.
How would that compare to the depreciation and software amortisation charges?
The P&L, I mean, yeah. Very roughly. I mean, obviously, property, let's just take out property. But if you take out that sort of top red line, essentially the software and hardware numbers are typically anywhere between sort of three and 5 years. So if you obviously divide that by three or, let's say four, divide that by 3.5 to 4, on an annual spend of about 4 million, that's roughly what your depreciation number is.
Okay, so I mean, it suggests that kind of you're not spending. These are partly this is capex, really, just to sustain what you're already doing, as opposed to real, genuine kind of growth-related capex. This is really just to maintain.
Well, it depends.
Systems maintained rather than.
No, not at all. I mean, I think Philip mentioned that we'd just been developing Rathbones Online. We've mentioned asset allocation modelling. All of those are significantly taking the business forward. And are in those numbers. So we've spent £1 million, let's say, on asset allocation modelling software. That isn't just maintaining the hardware. Now, some of that spend, we've been very successful, and you'll have seen in the first half, we've moved our second data centre site off-site. I mean, you could argue that's general maintenance. At the same time, if you're sitting on our business continuity committee, you're arguing that's a significant step forward in terms of our overall resilience and, you know, performance in the business. So, yes, we do have the standard sort of replace screens, replace servers, and all of that costs in there. But there's some very proactive spend on asset allocation modelling, for example, online capability that's in there as well.
Can I just extend that? I think we wouldn't be thinking of a fairly ambitious strategic growth plan if we felt that there was a huge need to replace our operating systems in the back. So the message continuously in the last sets of results has been where we're putting our money is into the front. Why? Because we know that our back office systems and platform is scalable to meet our growth requirements. We're proving that with these acquisitions. And therefore, it's modular as well, which allows us to operate on different parts of it and invest into different parts of it. So it's actually in very good shape for our plans. So unlike quite some of our competitors, we don't need to replace a legacy system in order to go to the new chapter.
Okay, I think the slide's useful. Just perhaps going forward, maybe it'd be perhaps even more useful if you could break out kind of what's being spent on kind of new growth-related CapEx and kind of what's more maintenance.
Okay, thank
and then
you.
Perhaps if you put that alongside what the depreciation and amortisation charges are, just so we can see kind of what really is being invested in the business. My sense is there is investment going into the business, and you've obviously outlined some of the initiatives, but that slide perhaps isn't as clear as perhaps it could
be. Very happy. Okay. Thanks for the point.
Jeremy Grime from Panmure Gordon. Three quick questions following on from the accelerated goodwill. Could you give us a little bit of detail about how your client-facing people are incentivized to bring in new clients, and what is the average period of amortization of client relationships? And then lastly, perhaps if I could understand what the acquisitions are doing to the average portfolio size, which has always been one of your great USPs, that would be helpful.
Okay, and in terms of how we remunerate, I mean, typically we would pay an upfront percentage of funds under management that are essentially brought in over a 2-3 year period. And obviously, depending on the circumstances, the rate that we pay is clearly dependent on the quality of the client base and indeed the overall size that of funds that are going to be brought in. So essentially that's how we work. It could be anywhere between 1%, could be up to 2.5% of funds under management.
Does the payment stop after, say, 3 years?
What happens is that it's typically a cash payment that can be structured within those 2 years, but the cut-off date will be the end of the period in terms of funds under management brought in.
Okay.
Yeah, does that make sense? So the final amount paid... Yeah. We'll end here, but there might be some cash along the way, is the point.
For 3 years, I don't particularly have an incentivisation to go and get more AUM other than my own profit.
You then come into the business-as-usual funds growth scheme. So we reward net funds growth of the individual. So you come out of your what we call earn-out, so your incentive during joining, and you move into the normal run rate funds growth scheme.
And would that be a lower percentage payment, typically?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And the average period of amortisation?
Average period of amortisation, typically what we will do is if funds come in without a fund manager, and we've had that, the amortisation period is 10 years. And it's 15 years if it comes in with a fund manager. So the average is very close to 15, I would say, but a little below 15 in terms of our amortisation period. And the rationale for that is that, and we test this time and time again, is how long the clients stay with us. And typically it's at least 20 years. What we are also doing every year is in the event that some clients leave, we will accelerate the goodwill. So essentially that will adjust, so we're not holding, if you like, intangible assets that can't be supported by client relationships. So there's quite an industry, I have to say, around this number to make sure that it's a fair representation of what value we've acquired.
Okay. So the impact of the acquisitions on average, in fact, will be a positive influence on that. Without going into too much detail, remember both businesses are London-based, which then by definition tends to have a higher portfolio size attached to it. And if you take, for example, the Jupiter business, the average client size was £980,000, so higher than our average. So actually there's a positive pull-through to be expected. That's in the discretionary portfolios. remember, with Jupiter, there was a large execution-only book as well.
Thank you very much.
Last question, because I can see people getting either needing coffee or to run.
It's Robin Savage from Canaccord again. Yeah. You mentioned that the IFA percentage was now 39% of your net inflows, and the target was 40. Would you think that there's any scope for any growth in that, and what are the constraints for the growth in the IFA introduced business?
Okay, and clearly there's scope for growth. One, because of our success, our momentum building in that area, and two, why are we having success in that area? Because others are, for one reason or another, losing their edge. I point to the number of integrations of houses who were traditionally very strong in the IFA world. So that consolidation has actually worked, maybe pro tem, but at the time being against them. I think there's a prudential management issue here of if we get to a flow dependency beyond 45%, I would start to put the brakes on. And the reason for that is attached to this is concentration risk. As you establish those relationships, and if the IFA industry continues to consolidate, for no fault of our own, you could find yourself suffering en bloc losses of client base when an IFA merges or moves. So at about 45%, I think the concentration of Mike running distribution will be around the quality rather than the quantity. So it's keeping that balance in the portfolio flow. Okay.
Coffee.
Thank you very much, everybody. We'll be around outside for coffee, but understand entirely if some of you have to run. Thank you very much.